Hello. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, August 16th, 1999. In Koinonia Fireside this morning is Christy Traina. The session number is 99-1. The title is Christianity and Childhood, Children in Western Theology. Let's listen in.
What happened after that? So we've gotten our text and now we're going to get our later stuff this morning. My name is Christy Traina and I teach at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. And the reason that I'm interested in talking about these topics this week is a project that I've been involved in this year, as have some other people who've been up at Holden this summer, working on the Western theological tradition and its ideas about children. I'd like to start out by just asking you, who in your thinking, experience, or past education is a child in relation to God? Not a child, just, you know, what we think of as developmental, but who is a child spiritually? What is
everybody.
A child's connection?
Everybody.
Everybody is a child of God,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
That's one way in which we think about it. Everybody is a child, and, you know, all of this literature about discovering your inner child, we're getting used to thinking about ourselves as children, but believe it or not, in Christian history, that's a pretty recent idea, okay? So in one sense, everyone is a child of God, and I'm going to talk more about that on Thursday. I don't write as well as Jan, so I hope you can remember what I was supposed to have written. But all are children of God. What other impressions do you have of children in relationship to God?
Faith like a child.
Okay, so children as spiritual models. What else?
Conceived in sin.
Okay, that's a big one, and that's a good connection to the non-existent doctrine of original sin, which we discussed earlier today. About the innocent karma. Okay, anything else theologically that springs to mind? No. Thank you. Anything else that springs to mind? Yes.
I think it's Paul, when I was a child, I felt like a child or acted like a child, but now I put away childish things.
Okay.
Think of that.
Children as childish, that might seem like a redundancy, but I think we'll discover that it isn't really. That there's the sense in which children are different from adults, they are not the same kind of animal. They grow into adults, but we don't think of them as complete or mature. Okay, anything else?
I think of Jesus as a child in the temple, asking questions, answering questions, kind of the, I don't know, the role of a student or learner.
Orphans have special status.
Okay.
As children.
Okay.
How about the old song of red and yellow, black and white? You know, that's all, but to include all children.
Okay. So it's.
Right. Don't turn the children away.
Also, the image of Christ saying, bring the little children come to me, etc. So this is meant to imply not only that all children are included, but that children, and I'll talk about this more in a little while, who are the least important members of, even they, is what this is often meant to apply historically, are included in the kingdom of God or in the church.
How about children as property? I'm thinking about Solomon with the dividing of the child.
This is a big one, and it exists not only in the Old Testament First Covenant, but it proceeds pretty far into Christian tradition, actually into the present day in some ways, and that's one of the tensions in historical understandings of children. Anything else?
Children as martyrs, the slaying of the innocents.
Okay. And you included two very important words there, not only martyrs, but innocents. Right? That there is something about them which is purer than other people, or less deserving of punishment. Right? Anything else that seems to matter theologically?
They're part of the household, and they're part of a unit.
So okay.
A mini tribe.
And especially in the Old Testament, when God is dealing, in some cases, more with units than people, they just come under this umbrella, right? That they're not treated as individuals. And in fact, in a lot of contemporary social teaching on the family in from Christian churches, that happens too, right? The children are just parts of this. They're not treated as beings which are external. Any other?
Children as offspring, which sounds redundant, but I mean that in the sense of the understanding of blessing, of fidelity, of
heirs, especially.
I have to say, you are doing really well. I asked a seminary theology class that had been studying the family in the Western tradition this question, and it didn't get as many answers out of them. So, if any of you are wondering whether you could make it through seminary, if you haven't gone.
Yes.
Our seminary SAT, you have really gotten. I honestly did not get as many answers. Maybe I didn't give them very much time. But with anything else, we want to add to this.
But a child's faith can be based on, how to say that, they don't necessarily believe or understand what they believe, but they believe it wholeheartedly, whereas adults learn more, we go to science classes and stuff, we start doubting everything.
Okay.
Blind faith.
Didn't want to write all that down. That's the problem. We're always trying to get the two-word summary so we can actually stick it up there, but we need that as the symbol. Now, if we look at this list, we notice that they're not exactly in concert with each other. In some ways, all are children. In other ways, we really don't want to be one of those at all, because we want to make sure that we're perceived as more mature than that. They're conceived in sin, and yet they're innocent. They're property or members of a unit, and yet individually, Jesus loves the little children of the world one by one by one by one by one as individuals, right? And so there are heavily conflicting impressions of childhood in the Western tradition that we have picked up. And they all have roots. And one of the interesting things about our contemporary understanding of childhood in our culture and in our churches is that all of these conflicting understandings are still coexisting. Now, we need to take a lesson from Jan Otto in that we're never going to get all of this sorted out, and we don't want probably a neat, tidy, final picture ever. But we need to understand that there are a lot of conflicts among these traditions. I want you to think for another couple of minutes now about, not about children that you've heard about, as you've heard about them in the tradition, or about children as you have observed them. Most of us have, as parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, older sisters, or brothers, right? I want you to think a minute about your impression of childhood through your own experience as a child. Think back to your own childhood, and don't think about what you now think of your own childhood, but think about how it felt to be a child, and then tell me who a child is, or the characteristics of children. What do you think?
Vulnerable.
Okay.
Fun.
Kids play.
Joy seeking.
What was that?
Joy seeking.
Living in the present.
Yeah.
Not Not even 5 minutes from now, but now.
But now, yeah.
Spontaneous.
Okay. I think I need a different marker. Hold on.
Can you define us just slightly? At what age does childhood end?
I don't want to do that yet.
It's hard to give a definition.
Okay. Think about under 10 for now. But I'll explain why I said I don't want to do that yet.
Impressionable.
Okay.
Always wanting to be like the grown-ups. Wanting to be included.
Dominating.
Yeah.
Attention seeking.
Seeking acceptance.
That's
attention.
I guess I'll say mimic for wanting to be like an adult.
Trusting.
Okay.
Dependent.
What was that?
Dependent.
But also independent.
Yes.
Yes, I
can't find the person that's trying to get support.
That's right. That's right.
No, don't help me. I want to do it.
Curious.
Inquisitive,
always asking why.
Now, I hope you're all being honest, remembering yourselves these ways. In relation to God, who were you in your own experience?
Fearful.
So God was an ominous presence. Anybody else?
Ominous, a loving presence also.
Okay.
See it both ways.
I was thinking that maybe you should be loved, that if you felt loved.
Okay.
A loving presence or feeling. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Safe.
Mm, security.
Yeah.
Special.
Little.
More self-serving. Not seeing how God affects other people's lives. But
okay. Jesus, my friend.
I think lazy. Lazy about studying about God.
Bored.
It's going to be there.
Right.
Remember how long church used to take?
It takes forever. How much longer is it
going
to be? The important thing about this is first of all, when Western theologians write about children, they're not always remembering how it actually feels to be a child. And one of the things that we can see here, first of all, is that there are a lot of conflicts within a child's experience. Children feel independence, and yet they want security, and they feel as though they need the support of others. Okay? There's an impatience that comes with boredom, and yet they're also very curious. And we all remember ourselves feeling in these ways. Okay? So that our reductionist understanding of what a child is isn't going to work, because there are all these pieces in the experience. Okay? That's one of the reasons the conflicts in the Western tradition aren't necessarily a huge problem, but they do create some odd and interesting consequences. Policy consequences or theological consequences that we really need to be aware of. In the sense I'm going to talk about what some of these connections to the tradition are. One of the things that's going to feel odd about it is that I'm going to be talking against an argument that most of you are not going to feel devoted to. Because what has happened in the Western tradition is that really early on, there was pretty strongly developmental understanding of the person. In fact, a developmental understanding that goes a lot later than we're used to thinking about. I mean, we're used to developmental kindergartens or developmental sixth grade classes, but we're not used to thinking about college developmentally unless we just came out of graduate school in the last 10 years or so, or about being 20 developmentally. But there was a developmental understanding of the person. And as we got past the Reformation, I don't want to say that that disappeared. It didn't entirely, but it wasn't at the center stage. Okay, and so it didn't really reemerge strongly until this century, when Christian churches, instead of asking what theologians thought about children, started asking what psychologists thought about children and sociologists thought about children. So that in this century, we really haven't had very much theological reflection at all on childhood. And this is where we're beginning to try to pick it up again, look back at the tradition and see what people have said. One of the fascinating things about looking at the Western theological tradition is that most of the people who are the, what do I want to say, the peaks in the tradition, the names who get read in seminaries and graduate schools, right, either don't talk a lot directly about children, you have to get it out of the fringes of their arguments, or they actually wrote a lot about children, but nobody translates it, republishes it, or writes about it. Okay? So pretty much all of the Western tradition on children has happened at the fringes or has been lost. And what I want to do today is fill in a little bit that will help us explain where, other than from our own experience, we get all of these categories, and what it means to us theologically that that happens. I have some quotes, and these are from the fathers, as we say, not from the mothers of the tradition, most of whom didn't write very much, or whose thoughts were reported by others. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some of these. I'm just going to pass them out so that you have something to look at when I get to them. Has anybody heard of Clint Aurier? No? Okay. There was a theory put forth by an historian in the 1960s that up until the 18th century or so, people, first of all, didn't think of childhood as a central stage of life. And secondly, weren't very attached to children because, you know, half of them died anyway. So the way they protected themselves from great emotional distress was by ignoring children pretty much until they grew up. If we look at the theological tradition, we can tell that that's not true. And if we look at the historical record, we can tell that's not true. But it's been a battle ever since he wrote that for people to prove that. Now, early in the tradition, people picked up on a classical theme, classical Greek and Roman philosophy, that the person went through a series of stages of development. And what I'm going to read to you is from Thomas Aquinas, although it was used by Augustine, it was used by everybody right up through the Middle Ages. So for more than half of Christianity, people believe that children develop in stages. Okay? There are some variations according to gender here. Thomas is usually talking about boys. Girls kind of follow the same path, except very often they get sort of chopped off at an earlier stage of life than the boys do. The first stage is when a person neither understands by himself nor is able to learn from another. The second stage is when a man can learn from another but is incapable by himself of consideration and understanding. The third degree is when a man is both able to learn from another and to consider by himself. And since reason develops in man by little and little in proportion as the movement and fluctuation of the humors is calm, Thomas was really worried about these sort of chaotic passions inside a person that were running around in all these different directions, and so you learned to quiet those down, you couldn't be reasonable. So that's what he's talking about there. Man reaches the first stage of reason before his seventh year, and consequently during that period he's unfit for any contract and therefore for betrothal. But he begins to reach the second stage at the end of his first 7 years, wherefore children at that age are sent to school. But man begins to reach third stage at the end of his second 7 years as regards things concerning his person, for instance, marriage, when his natural reason develops, but as regards things outside his person, for instance, property, at the end of his third 7 years. Now, this was partly because canon law at that point had said, okay, you can get married at 12 or 14 at puberty, but you can't own property until you're 21, etc. There was this incredible interdependence between civil law and ecclesiastical law, and so a theologian who was going to talk about ethics had to kind of be responsible to all of it and develop reasons for everything. Then, very often, one would not really, if one were male, become a full adult, that is, have one's own property and be completely independent of one's father, until about the late 20s or early 30s. So if we're looking at a developmental understanding of human person, how long it takes a man, at least, to become an adult, we're talking very often 30 years or more here. So we're not talking you're a child until you're 14. You're not really fully an adult until later. In fact, for somebody like Thomas Aquinas, the whole point of being on earth is a return to God. So in fact, your entire life is a development. Right? You're not just worried about getting to 21 and here you are, here it arrives, right? Your whole life is the process of returning to God and of becoming a mature person. So you're never really there in most cases. For girls who normally either married or entered a convent, the important age was 14 or puberty, because they didn't get to go on and do all those other things like owning property. So canonically or legally, they were as adult as they were going to be by about puberty, okay? Which is very different. One of the interesting things about Thomas and this idea of the stages of life is that right up through the Middle Ages, guess who was responsible for kids before seven? The mothers, right? And the role of the father, the educator, the rational education of the child, was supposed to begin in the second stage. I wonder how those kids got so smart. Up to seven, how did their brains develop if their mothers were incapable of educating a rational human being and their fathers were supposed to take over that job? One of the funny inconsistencies of the Western tradition on the raising of children is that these unreasonable women somehow get these children to the point of being rational so their fathers can educate them. But the interesting thing about the Western tradition on children is what we've discovered in the process, and I really want to say we, it's about 15 or 20 of us all working together, and it's our collective knowledge, not my research, that you're going to hear about, is that the understanding of who a person is completely breaks down when any theologian starts talking about kids. Think back to the Bible study this morning. God creates Adam and Eve. How old do you suppose they were in the Garden of Eden? Do we get the impression of their being, what?
20s.
Yeah, adults, if not psychologically and philosophically, at least physically. Here they are, full grown. Now, apparently with some degree of rationality and responsibility, right, able to make whatever decision it is we decided they were actually making when they took the fruit from the tree of knowledge, good and evil, or of good and evil. Well, the odd thing about most theologians is that they really are not sure what to do with children. And almost anything they do with children ends up being very uncomfortable at some point. The main sticking problem, can anyone guess what that is? Why they have such a problem talking about children?
Most are men.
Most are men.
They're not comfortable with smaller children.
Right. A lot of theologians, at least up till the Reformation, didn't have any direct experience with children, or if they did, it was their idealized memory. Some of these theologians grew up from about the age of 5 or 6, you know, without women or families around them very much. So, first of all, they have this funny idea of who children are. There's also a theological problem that turns up around the time of St. Augustine, which is, right, this non-biblical or sort of semi-biblical doctrine called original sin. And the difficulty is trying to explain in what way original sin is significant and how it affects a child's salvation and their personality and their position in the church. Let's put that marker on the is original sin. And they have very, very different understandings of this, and it can be traced all through the tradition. St. Augustine was a strong believer in non-innocence. Have any of you ever read the Confessions of St. Augustine? Okay. Augustine describes his own spiritual journey in the Confessions, and he is very hard on himself as a child. Okay. This is the first quote I've got on here. And Augustine really cemented for us the doctrine of original sin. Who can recall to me the sins that I committed as a baby? For in your sight, God, no one is free from sin, not even a child who has lived only one day on earth. If babies are innocent, it is not for lack of will to do harm, but only for lack of okay? These babies have an evil intent. They are bent on all the wrong goods, or all the right goods for all the wrong reasons. And if they could only coordinate their little muscles and use their little mouths to form words, they would be terrors. I mean, the image that Augustine gives is of, you can imagine a family with two young children. The two-year-old has just been displaced by the newborn. The newborn has just finished nursing and is like this, you know, awful. And the two-year-old comes up and wants to nurse. And the newborn suddenly sort of wakes up, screams, and goes for the breast. No, this is the greed of the baby, the newborn child, that they want what they don't need simply because they want to keep their sibling from having it in their territory. And this is Augustine's vision of the child, so that if only that they could gather their energies, they would be absolute terrors. And what happens in Augustine then is that adults, it's not that children are little adults, it's that adults are big children. They do develop rationally. That's good, right? They can sort things out. They can organize their thoughts. They can make plans. But they also become physically and mentally more able to act on these evil desires. And so the older they get, the more harm they can do. Okay? Their wills are no more evil, but their capacities to do harm are infinite as they grow older. And so the older you get, the more dangerous your sinfulness becomes to other people and to yourself and to the church. This is why baptism is so incredibly important. Marty Storz, who has written on Augustine and whom many of you, some of you may know, has said, I'm looking for her wonderful quote, of Augustine, that baptism admitted one into the hospital of grace where one spent a lifetime convalescing. Okay? So baptism is the only thing that can begin to break the hold of this non-innocence, this original sin that holds you captive. Well, once you've gotten past Augustine on original sin and Anselm on on Christ, the idea that Christ dies to atone for our sins. I mean, at one time this was a new idea, okay, that we are so awfully evil that God's justice requires someone to pay our fine for us. Okay? And that Jesus does this for us on the cross. After Anselm, you get this idea that everything has to balance out. It has to be justice in the world. So, if you have sinned, you need to be punished, right? If you haven't sinned, well, maybe you shouldn't be. And then the question is, what about original sin? Because you didn't do anything to deserve that, you see. That's not your fault. What about original sin? Well, St. Thomas Aquinas comes along, and this is a long time later, and he says, well, it's true that young children bear the mark of original sin. I agree with Augustine. And Thomas and all the medievals felt that they couldn't toss away anything that anyone had said before. They might interpret it so that it meant the exact opposite, but they had to say that they accepted it. So he came along and said, well, Augustine's right. Young children do not actually sin because they can't. But they still do bear the mark of original sin. So what do we do about this? Because we don't want to say that little children whose parents didn't get around to baptizing them are going to hell. That doesn't seem fair. They didn't do anything wrong, right? So what he said was that they had actual innocence. They hadn't done anything bad, but existentially they were still guilty because they had this mark of original sin on them. You see what kind of problems this starts to create for people here. So Thomas says, well, there's this other thing called the baptism of desire. And usually he refers to adults with this. If a person wants to be baptized and somehow dies before they can be, that means they're in effect baptized. Okay? God accepts them as if they were baptized. Well, what about children who can't really understand baptism very well? Is it their fault if they don't get baptized? If they can't go up at the age of 3 and say to mom and dad, I want to be baptized, if they don't understand it. So Thomas says that children up to the age of reason who aren't baptized, well, they can't have the baptism of desire. So they can't go to heaven. But it wouldn't be fair if they went to hell, because it's not their fault that they have the mark of original sin. So they go to this in-between place called limbo. Have anybody heard of that before? It's being gradually ditched by Roman Catholic teaching finally. But it's the idea that you go to this sort of gray area in between heaven and hell, where you won't be really close to God, but you won't suffer at all. And not only won't you suffer, but you won't really mind not being close to God, because you understand that it wouldn't be fair for you to be near God because you weren't baptized. And, you know, that would be okay with you. You would think it was all right. So that's fair.
You're talking about purgatory, is that
right? No, it's not. It's kind of like purgatory, but you're not suffering.
Okay.
Yeah, and you never leave. You know, you just stay there.
Yeah,
I'm not sure. You can think of your own analogy. I'm not going to try. But then there's this moment, and this is a fascinating thing at Thomas. If the unbaptized child, and I left a quotation mark out here, I'm sorry, that is beginning to have the use of reason, immediately directs himself to the due end. That means the absolute good as he understands it. He chooses the good as he understands it. He will, by means of grace, receive the remission of original sin. Whereas if he does not then direct himself to the due end, the absolute good as he understands it, as far as he is capable of discretion at that particular age, he will sin mortally, that is, consign himself to hell until further notice, through not doing that which it is in his power to do. So somehow at the age of reason, you become capable of choosing the absolute good in some chaotic, vague way and saving yourself from hell, or committing a mortal sin, which you'll then need to be baptized and forgiven to get out of.
Well, it's almost a sin by omission, then.
Right.
By not making the choice.
Right.
You suffer.
Right. Exactly. But we still have this idea of having to have everything come out even. You know, mm-hmm. You get what you deserve. Mm-hmm. So you have to do something or not do something to deserve it. Thomas wasn't particularly concerned about the faith of a child. That didn't really have a great deal to do with whether baptism could erase original sin and set them on the path to salvation. It was the faith of the church and the parents and the godparents into which the child was baptized, which they would then acquire later on as they were educated. Martin Luther, interestingly enough, wasn't satisfied with that. The connection between faith and grace was important enough for Martin Luther that you couldn't really have an infant baptized unless they had faith. And so he had to explain that a child had faith. He said, for an adult might receive and come to Christ as a Judas and have himself baptized, but a child cannot deceive. This is the simplicity of childhood, right? He comes to Christ in baptism as John came to him and as the children were brought to him, that his word and work cannot be without, that his word and work might be effective in them, move them and make them holy, because his word and work cannot be without fruit. Yet it has this effect alone in the child. Were it to fail here, it would fail everywhere and be in vain, which is impossible. So for Luther, baptism absolutely was necessary to remove original sin, and to therefore open the door of possibility of heaven. This isn't the same as the moment of justification necessarily, when you become marked as simultaneously saved and a sinner, but it's the moment when you become able to receive God's grace and enter the community of the church, sort of the prerequisite for salvation. Luther too felt then that you had to have this balance and that this mark of original sin had to be erased, and that furthermore you had to explain that the child really did have faith. In the same way that Augustine would say, well, this child is really evil and can't you see, Luther would have to say, well, this child really can have faith, even though we can't see it very well, we can't express it, still this there. God can work faith in the child, therefore the sacrament will be efficacious, what will work. Now, interestingly enough, not all of the reformers felt the same way about the connection between faith and baptism. They all felt that you had to have some sort of balance there. But in John Calvin, this idea that God chooses whom he will save, and it was always a he, right, was even more important than it was for Luther, and became much more important after Calvin. So that whether or not you were going to be saved was pretty much predetermined. But what happens to the importance of baptism then?
It's essential. It's absolutely necessary.
Well, it doesn't make any difference, right? I mean, if God says...
It's essential, but inevitable.
It's inevitable. It's not the baptism that creates the salvation and the possibility for salvation. If God can pull the strings and determine who's going to be saved, then God can probably make it turn out that you get baptized eventually.
Right.
But the baptism isn't what saves you, right? It's God's preordination, foreordination of whether you're going to be saved or not. So, Calvin is as convinced as anybody that infants are evil, right? Even infants bear their condemnation with them from their mother's womb, for though they have not brought forth the fruits of their own iniquity, they have the seed enclosed within themselves. Indeed, their whole nature is a seed of sin. Thus, it cannot but be hateful and abominable to God. Nature as a seed of sin. Here we come, Augustine comes rolling back in again. And yet, baptism is not so necessary that one from whom the capacity to obtain it has been taken away should straightway be counted as lost. So you can't be sure that someone who's unable to be baptized is damned because God already decides he's going to be saved. We can't do anything about it. If by some fluke somebody can't get baptized, well, don't worry too much about it.
The Luther thing brings to mind that we have older women in our church who said there was this period of time before the baby was baptized where you were super, super careful, because if that baby died before the baptism, that was critical. I mean, that was the worst thing that could happen.
Exactly, and that's why, although many of the reformers were against infant baptism, Luther pressed it. Many people think of Luther as being against infant baptism and against overusing the Eucharist. Not at all. Luther was very strong on those two sacraments, early baptism and frequent Eucharist. Those were two things that made him actually much more medieval than modern, and some of the other reformers were much more modern in that sense. And so that sense of needing to be very, very careful with an incense on Lutherans is the heritage of that doctrine of Luther's. You must be baptized. And yet, we have to explain that as somehow being a response to the infant's faith. Now, what's interesting that, about the Mennonites, when do Mennonites baptize? Anybody know?
Believer baptism,
right?
The end of that second stage.
Yeah, at least puberty, very often later, okay? Because they were not as convinced as Martin Luther that God somehow creates faith that makes baptism efficacious in the infant. They want to be able to hear you say in a mature voice that you have faith in God before you're baptized. Okay? Partly because the Anabaptist church, the Mennonite church, is a very small understanding of the church, the chosen few, right? Rather than like a Lutheran or Roman Catholic understanding that the church is the place where the wheat and the tares grow together and they get separated at the end, right? The Anabaptist point of view has been that the church is the place where you just want the wheat, thank you. And so you really want to make sure that people are committed before they're baptized into it.
Do they believe that original sin, evil?
Yes,
okay.
They did, and do. And the fascinating thing about that is, well, what about children below the ages of 12 or 18 or whatever it is?
Wallowing in sin.
They're in sin, but guess what?
Innocent sin.
Yes, exactly. Innocent sin, okay? Until they are old enough to declare themselves as members of the church or not, they're kind of grandfathered in through the special grace of Christ that prevents them from being sent to hell if they should happen to die before they're baptized. Okay? Because they are not old enough to really know what they're doing yet when they declare themselves in or out. And Menno Simons does not want to tell us what that age of maturity is. He wants to leave that pretty much to the individual. But he says, our entire doctrine, belief, and confession is that our innocent children, and by this he means unbaptized, as long as they live in their innocence, are through the merits, death, and blood of Christ in grace and partakers of the promise. So until they get to that age where they need to be responsible for themselves, Christ sort of says, okay, you're under probation period or something. You don't have to wait about it yet. Grace, thank you. That's the term I've been looking for. That's good.
The Mennonites have, and the Amish have a term for it too. They let their teenagers, for a couple of years,
yes,
sow their wild oats. It's their last spasm of this innocent sin, and then they're supposed to settle down and really settle down.
And this is actually, if you live in any Amish area, Yes, it's getting pretty intense currently, I understand. Much more intense than it used to be. It's getting pretty intensely secular currently. But yeah, this is the period during which you can still go out and be English before you commit yourself to the church. So there's the sense, though, that that's a protected period. Now, I don't know how Amish elders feel about that period right now. It would be interesting to talk to them. Because I don't think this is what Menno Simons had in mind when he formulated the doctrine. What happens in the 18th century is that people do start to pick up, this is after Rousseau, etc. They do start to develop what we call, we think of as a more modern developmental understanding of child. Calvin, in Luther, in Wesley, in all these people that say very harsh things about early childhood, you also get these sort of idealistic musings about children and admirations of their cherubic qualities. At the same time, you know, that you get all of these very harsh things. John Wesley was one of the people that was in favor of a developmental understanding. Understand that when someone thought in a developmental way, it doesn't mean that they always came out with appropriate ways of teaching or appropriate ways of disciplining. They just thought that you should try to be appropriate. Okay? So very often there was a pretty big disconnect between what people actually did and what they thought they needed to make allowances for. John Wesley wrote lots and lots of books for children, developed schools for them in England, was very concerned about the lower and middle class children, not only the wealthier children, but had all kinds of interesting ideas, like children should never be allowed unsupervised random play. They should, if they wanted to play, they should do things like garden.
Productive play.
Yeah, right, yeah. Never let your children run up and down the street by any means. But he also maintained this incredibly strong idea of God's justice. And I'll just read this for you. I think it stands by itself. Why do infants suffer? What sin have they to be cured thereby? The parents are not the better, nor anyway likely to be the better for all the sufferings of their children, not too optimistic on parents either. Their sufferings, therefore, yea, and those of all mankind which are entailed on them by the sin of Adam, are not the result of mere mercy, but of justice also. In other words, they are punishment. In other words, they have in the nature of punishments, even on us and on our children. Therefore, children themselves are not innocent before God. They suffer, therefore they deserve to suffer. Okay? Talk about interesting reasoning.
Yeah.
Inductive. Yeah. If they're suffering, and if God is as big as we think God is, there must be a good reason. They must be evil.
So
and
kind of retribution.
Yes, retribution. And this is something that comes forward in a lot of popular understandings of childhood in this country, especially, I would say, in the 19th century and early 20th century. Then Jonathan Edwards is another interesting case. He was Puritan. Puritans thought that if you wanted to be saved, you needed to be converted. Okay? And this was a prerequisite. Conversion. Well, if that's a prerequisite to salvation, then you really want to accomplish it early, right? Because we still have to think of very high mortality rates, not only for infants, but also for children in the 18th century in this country and in Europe. So one of Jonathan Edwards' shticks was to preach conversion to children. And this was fairly rough preaching, actually. He would do these revivals, and if you want to read children's sermons, not as models for what not to do when you get called to do a children's sermon in your home parish, look at Jonathan Edwards. This is the sort of thing he would say to children. If you should die while you are young, and death should come upon you and find you without any love of Christ, what will become of you? Think of telling six-year-olds this, okay? Consider, you can't bear the wrath of God. You cannot endure eternal burnings. How dreadful it will be to be in hellfire amongst devils and know that you must be there to all eternity. God will have no mercy upon you. If you cry to him, he won't hear you. This is a sermon to children. And there are many, many stories from his parishes of very young children who underwent grueling conversion experiences and told of their great love of God and their fear of punishments and all of this at the age of 4 or 5 and were about trying to convert their parents, etc. This is the sort of thing that he would say to children. And then here we have his opinion on children. As innocent as children seem to be to us, if they are out of Christ, they are not so in God's sight, but are young vipers, and are infinitely more hateful than vipers. Infants are not looked upon by God as sinless, but are by nature children of wrath. The wicked are estranged from the womb. They go astray as soon as they be born, speaking lies. Okay? Instantly, as in Augustine, but with actually, I think, more agency than in Augustine. Right? These tiny babies are actually sinning. Not wishing they could sin, but actually out there sinning. In Edwards. It's not until a bit later, Friedrich Schleiermacher is probably one of the most important figures for whom children become models of innocence and purity, where the adult is the person who falls, right? Where the child is the model. It's not until much later that we start getting that. Schleiermacher kind of anticipates what happens in the late 19th and early 20th century. And what happens then, I'm going to talk about that a little bit on Thursday, is that sin moves out of the child and into the environment. Then guess who's responsible for all the failings of children? We are! Oh, good, right? And so then parents have to be concerned not that their child gets baptized and saved right away, but that they don't do anything that prevents their child from developing the proper kind of piety and virtue, right? So that the concern becomes less with original sin and the mark of original sin than that the parents don't damage the child and lead it in the wrong direction. And I think we can talk about some of that later this week. I want to make a quick circle back, and I, like everybody else, has to go to Narnia in a minute, so I don't want to overdo this. But I wanted to mention something about the Bible. In the Bible, by and large, people assume that you know what a child is. Children are a huge topic for conversation. And in the Gospels, when they come up, it's as much to explain God's incredible grace and love as it is to elevate the child. In other words, and this I get from Judy Gundry Wolfe, whom some of you may also know, who's a New Testament scholar. When Jesus wants to illustrate the inclusiveness of the reign of God, he picks up a child, right? Why is this important? Because children were not valued at all in Greco-Roman society, because they were property, because they were quite frequently exposed or abandoned, and this happened all the way up through the Middle Ages and later, right? If they weren't wanted. So that they were not great capital, really. And so what happens when Jesus picks up a child is not only to say that children are valuable, but it's to say that God's mercy extends even to those whom we think are unimportant. And so the image depends on the valuelessness of children, okay? in the surrounding society. And it also depends on the valuelessness of women, because Jesus is behaving like a woman when he picks up a child. Okay? So he's saying that God is someone who behaves like the second class citizens of the society and includes the third class citizens of our society. And so that is a play on the valuelessness of children. I think I'm going to stop there because of the need to make sure we pick up our kids and get them to lunch before they're absolutely falling apart. But I hope, and I haven't given you a chance to respond to these last things, but I hope that those of you who aren't running out to collect children or who have thoughts that they want to add will do so. And tomorrow we'll be talking a little bit about something very different, children's impressions of God through the eyes of Robert Coles, and then we'll go on to some other